A deal averts the looming port strike. From APM, this is the Marketplace Midday Update podcast. I'm Jeff Horwich. It is December 28th. After a quick update on that strike, we will talk about the end of that payroll tax break that you probably forgot you were even getting. We'll see how this whole fiscal cliff thing is playing overseas, find out why kids in eastern Montana are putting off college, and the iPhone, now available in Brazil. Apple ain't happy.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
So we'll start with a quick update to a story that we covered all morning, which was resolved just literally a few minutes ago. This morning, President Obama had urged dock workers and management at more than a dozen ports to work things out before their looming deadline. And they did, evidently. 15,000 unionized longshoremen had threatened to strike at midnight on Saturday over a pay dispute that would have shut down major ports from Maine to Texas, some 40% of container shipping coming into the U.S. But we got the basic news just moments ago, as I said, that the parties have reached a deal, and it looks like that strike is averted. So let's do the numbers. Not a happy morning on Wall Street, at least so far. The Dow is off about 0.5% at this early hour. 13,036 is where it's sitting. The S&P and the NASDAQ are off by similar amounts. Yesterday, we reported new home sales continue on something of a hot streak. Today, the data show existing homes in November were selling at their fastest clip in 2.5 years. The increase surpassed economists' expectations by a good bit. For the past 2 years, we've had a little break in our paychecks that many of us probably take for granted by now. The Social Security payroll tax was reduced back in 2011 to stimulate the economy. Well, that reduction has already been extended twice, but as lawmakers focus on extending income tax breaks now, our payroll tax holiday seems to have reached its end. Marketplace's Dan Bobkoff asks how much we should care.
There are two ways to look at the payroll tax holiday. Number one, it's a big deal, says Jared Bernstein of the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities.
We're talking about over $100 billion in stimulus added to people's paychecks.
Or number two, for a taxpayer making, say, $50,000 a year, it's a bit more cash, says Joseph Rosenberg of the Tax Policy Center.
That works out to be about $20 a week.
But did it help the economy? Joe Henchman is with the Tax Foundation.
I mean, it certainly didn't push us back to good times.
So what happens if we lose it? That depends on the fate of the Bush-era income tax cuts. Rosenberg says if those are extended,
then the impact of the expiration of the payroll tax is not likely to have a significant economic impact.
But whatever happens with income taxes, the payroll tax holiday appears over. I'm Dan Bobkoff from Marketplace.
Last week, the iPhone went on sale in Brazil. And that is nothing but a giant headache, it turns out, for Apple. Because, you see, 12 years ago, a cell phone company called Gradiente filed a request for that trademark. And Gradiente's Brazilian iPhone, the one that is now on the market there, runs the Android operating system that's made by Apple's nemesis, Google. One Brazilian telecom analyst suggests the likely outcome here. Apple pays Gradiente a considerable sum of money to pack up its iPhones and go away.
Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to FreakonomicsRadio.com.
Time, as I'm sure you surely know, is short to avoid the fiscal cliff at this point. But politicians are hustling. House members will return to Washington for a rare session on Sunday. Today, President Obama meets with top congressional leaders. The rhetoric, though, is not terribly encouraging. Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell says his party won't be pressured into a bad deal.
Republicans aren't about to write a blank check for anything Senate Democrats put forward just because we find ourselves at the edge of the cliff.
Senate Democratic leader Harry Reid, for his part, says Republicans are the ones holding things up.
We can't negotiate with ourselves because that's all we're doing. Unless we get a sign-off from the Republicans in the House and the Republican leader here, we can't get anything done.
We wanted to take a look at how this whole fiscal cliff thing is playing out internationally. Asian stock markets, for example, did well today. So how concerned are folks over there? Earlier today, my colleague Mark Garrison talked with the BBC's Mariko Oi, who is based in Singapore. Here's Mark.
So how are investors in Asia reacting to all this uncertainty over the fiscal cliff here in America?
Well, it's quite interesting, Mark, because if you just look at Asian markets and how shares have been performing, it even looks like they don't seem too bothered by what's happening in the United States. We saw Asian markets ending quite higher this Friday. But nevertheless, it's not to say that people aren't concerned about it. It has been making news headlines quite a lot because whatever happens in the United States, of course, affects Asian economies quite significantly. I remember back in 2008 when the global financial crisis was taking place, there were some experts here in Asia who said that Asia is completely decoupled, we're fine, and then economic figures started to fall rather sharply. So there is definitely a big concern among Asian investors and traders, but in terms of just the share performance over the last few days, they seem to be doing quite well.
Let's look specifically at Japan, where the Nikkei index has been on a tear all week. There is a new prime minister. The yen is weakening. Just talk about some of the factors that are driving Japanese shares specifically up.
Indeed, it's all to do with the Japanese yen, which has been uncomfortably high for many exporters because it makes their products more expensive overseas. But ever since the new prime minister, Shinzo Abe, took office, even during his election campaigns, in fact, he has been talking a lot of bold measures, if you like, about how to tackle the slugging economy, how to beat deflation, and how to weaken the Japanese currency. So as a result, traders have been selling quite a lot of the Japanese yen. We're seeing the level that we haven't seen in almost 2 years. And that's partly why that Japan's Nikkei index has been performing quite well as well. In fact, it has posted its best yearly performance since 2005, up 23% this year.
Okay, the BBC's Mariko Oi reporting from Singapore. Thank you, Mariko.
Thank you.
We have told you plenty on Marketplace about this energy boom that is unfolding in the northern plains states. It's why the U.S. is now forecast to be the world's biggest oil producer within a decade. Not surprisingly, the boom is affecting the economic and education choices of young people in the region. Reporter Jack Healy is based out of Denver, and he headed north to the vast plains of eastern Montana for a story in this week's New York Times. Jack, good to talk with you.
Thanks for having me on.
Give us the setting here. What is going on with gas and oil in eastern Montana?
Basically, you've got this huge energy boom centered in North Dakota, quickly flowing and spilling over into eastern Montana, which has oil and gas buried deep in the rocks as well. And so in the last few years, there's been a real transformation of this rural landscape. You've got new drilling rigs, you've got new companies, and you also have job opportunities for high school kids that were sort of unheard of just a couple years ago, when the best you could do was maybe pulling, you know, ice cream at the Dairy Queen or working at a McDonald's.
What kinds of jobs are these young people taking, and in some cases, putting off college in order to take?
Yeah, there are jobs that involve a lot of secondary work in the oil fields, doing things like repair work on those rigs and on those wells once they're up and running, making basic kind of deliveries out to the oil fields, and even jobs that don't seem to have a lot to do with the oil fields. I interviewed one girl who's working as a cashier at a gas station that serves a lot of these companies in North Dakota, and she's making $24 an hour doing that work.
Well, these are jobs, and jobs are great, and people bemoan those magical days when students could land a good job right out of high school. So what is the worry here?
The worry here, I think, is that this kind of song has been heard before in parts of the country that have seen these resource booms, right? I'm here in Colorado, and 20, 30 years ago, there was this great natural gas boom and this sort of shale boom that dried up almost overnight, and it created sort of massive unemployment. And I think that's one of the concerns here, is that, you know, it's good now, but what happens if the price of oil for some reason falls precipitously? You know, what happens to these kids if in, you know, 5 years there are suddenly mass layoffs and, you know, they don't have college or associate's degrees? But for the moment, you know, they're making good money and they seem to be happy with these decisions.
Jack Healy with the New York Times. Thanks very much.
All right. Thanks so much.
Most charitable foundations follow a time-worn formula. They take a big pot of money, usually bequeathed by some rich guy, and invest it for a profit. Then they take those profits and they donate to charity. That's a great system, unless you aren't actually earning a profit. Alex Goldmark reports on how foundations are turning to something called impact investing as a solution in tough times.
Some foundations have a problem. Tom Blaney is an accountant at O'Connor Davies. He has hundreds of foundations as clients, and many of them are worried over their return on investment.
So by giving out 5%, which is required by tax law, and we're only making 1% or 2%, in essence, we're depleting our endowment every year, and theoretically we could spend ourselves out of existence.
One solution, he suggests, is something called impact investing. That's a for-profit investment, but with a social goal, too.
Many more foundations, large and small, are looking at the PRI concept.
Impact investing is a trend that's long overdue, according to Luther Reagan. He heads the Global Impact Investing Network. He says charitable foundations are sitting on big pots of money, and those endowments should be put to better use.
To be perfectly honest, foundations today are like private investment companies. The fact is that 95% of their resources are invested in conventional ways without regard to the social purposes or mission that the foundation was created.
There are many ways a foundation can invest for social impact. There's microloans to fight poverty or playing venture capitalist to a company that monitors for counterfeit drugs in India. Matt Bannock is the head of the Omidyar Network. It's part charitable foundation, part investment firm, and makes those kinds of loans.
If you're a straight commercial investor, you'd say, that's not enough, and you'd walk away. We would say, oh my goodness, look, there's a firm that's delivering significant positive social impact, and they're generating a profit.
Which means the Omidyar Network will get its money back and use it again on a future loan.
On the other hand, when you provide a grant, you're guaranteed to lose 100% of your money.
In New York, I'm Alex Goldmark for Marketplace.
That report was funded, in part, in the old-fashioned way, by a grant from the Rockefeller Foundation. And finally, speaking of charity, I guess, in this holiday season, news that the spirit of gift-giving has been alive and well in the South Pacific. A paper published this month in a journal called Anthrozoos says wild dolphins off Australia have been doing something kind of odd. They've started bringing presents to the researchers who study them. Eels, squid, that kind of thing. House cats do this sort of so-called interspecies food sharing, right? Dropping a bird on your front welcome mat or something like that. But this has never really been seen before in the wild. Scientists are at a loss for a clear explanation, but here's one theory that is less than flattering. The dolphins see us humans as incapable hunters, and so they're offering us a helping fin. That is today's Marketplace Midday Update. I'm Jeff Horwich. Everybody have a good weekend. This is APM, American Public Media.